This hour is brought to you by Jewel Osco. Check the For You app for more deals.
Different way of eating, you know, like I had to work to get here. There's certain things that if I was 7 foot and could shoot threes and shoot turnarounds and play off the dribble, score 30 a night for 15 years, I would do that, and I probably wouldn't be as good at defense. That's probably just the reality of it. But for me, you know, it's a different path. It was a different way of me to figure out how to get in the league. And for me to get on the court in the beginning, I had to guard. I had to use my 4 to 8 minutes a night and turn that into 10 to 12 and then turn that into 20 and I'll turn it into, you know, having a really good couple of years here in Chicago. So I think for me, it's just about the path and just facing reality of what I was given with. And, you know, obviously I've worked to become somewhat of a threat on the offensive end, but the defensive end is where I kind of had to find my niche to get into the league.
He did, man. Alex Caruso, he was asking, Sam Smith, rather, was asking Caruso that question. You can tell Sam's cooking up an Alex Caruso feature, and I like where his head was at because Sam Smith just facilitates conversation, and there was a lot of that going on at Bulls practice yesterday. I love hearing Caruso talk about what he did to have to stay employed in the NBA.
What did he have to do?
Well, he talks about it there a little bit, but also just if you're not going to have the elite 1% of talent in the NBA, then you're going to have to figure out how to make a living. And he's done that with working on his defense and doing the things that a lot of people don't want to do.
And getting way better at his 3-point shot.
Yeah. And he was practicing that, I would say, for at least 15 minutes from what we saw at yesterday. And I know he's probably worked on it even more than that in practice all day yesterday. But that was definitely something that he was specifically repeating over and over yesterday at practice.
What else did you see while you were there?
Well, we know Billy Donovan loves to talk. So do we. That's why we're on from 10 to 2.
Yep.
On the score. But
middays.
The thing is, I think there's not a lot of places for Billy's observations that breathe, except here. You know, TV pre- and post-game show, you only get half an hour. Radio pre- and post-game show can be quick. You want to take calls. And in various column inches formats like newspaper or The Athletic, maybe you've got a certain amount of words you have to stick to. But we have time for when Billy Donovan wants to talk about things like supporting Dan's theories about clutch statistics.
Some of that, you know, to me gets a little bit misleading, you know, in some ways, because you think about Sacramento, you're down by 22 points and you're fighting your way back to get into the game, right? Well, you have to have that plus-minus margin to overcome that. You know, we've had some situations where we've come back from pretty big deficits. But I get what you're saying, like it's within that range. But if you have a possession, it's a 5-point game, and then someone makes a three and it turns to eight, well, that possession doesn't count. So you're just looking at the possessions that are there, and sometimes those possessions aren't always consecutive, you know, over the 5 or 6 minutes. I think DeMar has been really, really good closing games, quite honestly. You know, I think that's been good. I think that I feel like we've generated some good shots, and I think Kobe and the emergence of Kobe and Io in some of those situations, even Vooch. You know, Alex made a big three against Toronto early in the year. We've had other guys other than DeMar, and I think we've made some pretty key shots in crucial situations. I think we've been able to get some stops. You know, that always helps when you can get some stops and not foul and give up offensive rebounds. We tried to make it a point of emphasis this year because I think that the year before last we were pretty good at, and last year we weren't quite as good. You know, we really had so many games. I think it was 19 games where it was either overtime, last minute, or last possession, you know, that we lost of all those games. So I think there's something we tried to focus on and be better at. But sometimes you can be better in those situations, and there are margins of do you get breaks? You know, like I think last year we ended up beating New York, we were dead in the water, and Brunson and Julius Randle just forced consecutive free throws, right? Like, that's luck that works out your way. You know, 0.5 seconds, they throw it up to, you know, Griffin in Atlanta, he 360 turns and throws it in with 0.5. Like, you know, that's, you can't sit there and say, like, that's, you know, you're necessarily always, it was a great play by him, but sometimes things, you know, just don't go your way in those moments. I mean, being up by, you know, Vooch's against Orlando last year, I think we're up by two, we got a chance to go up four, miss both free throws, Suggs comes down and launches a three at the buzzer, and we lose, you know. So those things happen. Some of that stuff's kind of gone, happened positively for us where we've made some of those plays. And I think the guys, to be honest with you, I feel like they've done a good job executing in those moments on both ends of the floor, to their credit.
I knew you'd love it.
He's talking about tonight's game. When he's talking about how the margin for error is slim, we've got to get some stops and not allow offensive rebounds in critical situations. He's talking specifically. I mean, I know he wasn't, but I can infer what is not being implied. That sounds like my notes for tonight.
I mean, he did also say they were bad at those games last year, which we knew. We knew that. And he said we made it a point to work on close games, and they played 11 overtime games in the regular season. So I feel like that part of it was valid. But when he talks about how you get into a clutch situation, I knew you would appreciate his answer, Dan.
I just know that when I'm listening to the game and I hear that, I just often will roll my eyes because of everything that Billy's saying. Like, yeah, I don't think that it proves anything. And if anything, it proves that if you are searching for clutch, like if you're grabbing for it and you're trying to look at the Bulls and say, well, they're a clutch team, it doesn't even prove that.
I think it does at times when they say we want to win close games and we lost last year. We need better plays drawn up to free up our better shooters.
But,
like, I
but
feel
they
that.
Haven't won them.
Right. And if they simply made more three-pointers, they wouldn't be in those situations.
They're not, like, to me, I don't know. Like, it's always hard to define, and the NBA is trying to give you a definition of clutch. It's just that when I looked at their record, I can look at their record and go, oh, you guys are not clutch.
Right, and they're not. I mean, we've been hoping they would get to 500 all season, too, and that didn't happen.
I also did some research on the narrative, because we noticed it was around the middle of the season when we began hearing about the idea of clutch games. And my first thought was, okay, this is the team building out a talking point, trying to come up with something they can put high in their notes.
But they weren't building it out. Like, it was discussed last year where they were struggling.
So I asked. It wasn't the team. It has not been team-driven. This has been broadcast-driven.
And it's not just broadcast.
But it's primarily through the broadcast that has leaned on the clutch thing. I thought it was top-down. And I thought, well, this is the broadcast simply responding to the team, like, hey, we're pushing this. You know, make sure you mention this. And it has not been from a team level.
I could have told you that. I thought I did. But I'm just saying, when it comes, it's just a measurement. And in the NBA, they love to find measurements for things that we would like to explain with a pattern. And last year is when we started talking about this, because the year before, you know, DeMar was on that incredible run. At one point, the Bulls were in first place in the East. Everything was wonderful. And then we saw them deteriorate in these late game close situations.
Or was that 2 years ago?
2 years ago, they won them because DeMar made the shots. And
the year before, but I'm saying the year before.
It was 2 years ago, and Billy said it.
But
he said that too. Billy said
unsustainable.
We got a lot of luck and a lot of these wins.
I was saying the year before, the year they started talking about losing in clutch situations, the Bulls were losing. There was a measurement there that actually made sense. They were the least clutch team in the NBA. But there's a way to apply it that makes logical sense, and that's what Billy was talking about. This year, they made it a point of focus, but it was really more about winning in the games that they know they should win. Like last year, you remember they lost off of that baseline set that just wasn't covered defensively. Those are the things that shouldn't happen.
Right, but to me, it's not a great measurement because of the stuff that Billy was saying.
Right.
That you can...
It's silly.
That if you were more clutch, you wouldn't play yourself into clutch situations where you're up. So, like, if you're a more clutch team, then when you are up 20 points, then you're supposed to step on the other team.
And rest your starters.
That's the real concern. And if I had had more time at practice, I would have asked about, to a guy like Alex Caruso, like, are you okay? Like, you've been playing
a
lot of minutes.
No, he's not okay. He's very far from okay. He's in horrible pain. Watch him.
He's not Marcellus Wallace.
I'm not saying that's what happened.
Isn't that what he said? I'm very far from being okay.
Yes, but I'm not implying. I'm not implying that's what happened to Alex Caruso. But he's the guy's beat up every single night, and he's questionable for the moment the All-Star break hits. He's questionable for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
He's on fumes.
His California privileges have been revoked.
The whole team is on fumes.
I will say this. I talked earlier about Sam cooking up a Alex Caruso feature, and we did just talk about how Alex basically gets in where he fits in.
Shout out to Sam Cook.
He's dead.
No, we're not doing this. Their work is alive. Whoa. The work is alive.
No, Sam's been dead for like 50 years.
I know, but the work.
Wasn't there some stuff too? Sam Cook slept with somebody's wife.
Yeah, it was Marvin Gaye that was killed by his own dad, right?
See, this is why I wanted to keep it. But there was something.
Yes, I don't know exactly what it is, but you're right about Sam Cooke.
Point being, Sam Smith was cooking up the feature.
That's what it is. Bobby Womack wrote a song, Layla, called "I Wish He Didn't Trust Me So Much."
Oh, what the hell? That's like that new Smokey Robinson album.
No, it's worse. Mm-mm.
Descriptive titles eating the things you don't need to know about.
So Bobby Womack was sleeping with Sam Cooke's wife.
Messed up.
And then wrote the song.
I wish he didn't. That's messed up.
But
that's,
you know, Sam Cooke wasn't no punk. And so at the funeral, if I'm remembering, all this is like rushing back. After the funeral, Bobby Womack got his ass whooped by Sam Cooke's people because of that song.
It's messed up. Song was more of a betrayal than the act.
Sam Cooke was shot and killed by Bertha Franklin, who the manager of a motel, who said she shot him in self-defense. And the police record states she shot Cooke. Franklin said he banged on the door of her office shouting, "Where's the girl?"
Whoa.
In reference to Elisa Boyer, a woman who'd accompanied him to the motel and who called the police from a telephone booth. And then an enraged Cooke forced the way into her office, naked except for one shoe and a sport jacket, and he grabbed her and she shot him.
You guys wanted to talk about this instead of actual practical things for a playing game tonight?
I just wanted to get to the bottom of this. You should hear the song, though. Trust me so much. Like, you talk about...
I bought you things you couldn't even pronounce.
Yeah, Orange Juice Jones. You talk about beef. Like, this stuff that's going on with Drake and J. Cole and Kendrick Lamar. And you were talking about beef. This dude wrote a whole song about you sleeping with this guy's wife.
Why act guilty? Why broadcast that?
Oh, that's right. And then, like, I want to say then Bobby ended up dating Sam Cooke's daughter.
What? Oh.
It's so gross, guys.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know much about history.
Well, we don't have time for the other piece of audio that I thought was pretty compelling. No, it's 4 minutes.
Damn it.
That's
why
I was trying to get us back on topic, but neither one of you guys cared.
This is interesting stuff, though.
No, because I used to, because this.
No, Dan's just trying to get us $5 out of the mythical death jar.
I knew he was dead. I don't get $5 back.
Yeah, he killed Ron Jeremy.
Name somebody you know is dead so you get $5 out of the mythical death jar.
Hun. I can't write. I don't get to return the money in the wrongful death jar.
Egyptian pharaohs, all of them.
Tut died at like 15, right? I think.
Why don't we 13? Talk some sky? Let's get some answers to some questions about some things.
And their general manager, Jeff Pagliacca, will join us next on The Score.
Bernstein and Holmes, middays 10 to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
With the 7th pick in the 2024 WNBA draft, the Chicago Sky select Angel Reese, LSU.
Can we also, just from a surface level standpoint, shout out all the fashion on not only the WNBA draftees, but the executives? That was fun. And Dawn Staley had on like this really cool Louis Vuitton jacket. That was the championship outfit. Well,
they call her Louis Vuitton Dawn, right?
Can we just call her back?
I want to go on the walk with her. I'll walk Champ. I'll walk her dog, Champ. It's good. Yesterday, we had a conversation with Annie about the fashion. About the fashion at the WNBA draft and how the women are so far ahead of the men from a fashion standpoint.
And one thing I learned yesterday, I learned that Prada had never outfit an NBA player before. And the fact that they outfit Caitlin Clark yesterday was certainly a very public choice on their part, and we detailed the reasons why. Time for us to talk about one of the teams abuzz in this city, the Chicago Sky, with their general manager, Jeff Pagliacca. He is on Twitter, at Jeff Pagliacca, and he joins us on the Score Hotline presented by Circus Sports Illinois. Download the Circus Sports app today, twitch.tv/Chicago670. The Score. Jeff, how are you?
I'm good, you guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. Considering what's happened over the last couple of years where the Sky go from being a championship team to kind of restarting things, when you came in, how big of a job was this to try and get things corrected?
Well, as soon as free agency started, we realized we had to pivot and trade Kalia Copper. So, you know, once that happened and we were able to rebuild some draft capital from that trade and get some young players in, that was kind of the start of a few moves that we made that put us in position, you know, for the draft a couple days ago.
How competitive do you expect to be this season?
We plan on being extremely competitive. We have an extremely competitive coach. We have a core full of competitive players, and we're bringing in, obviously, quite a few that had a lot of success in the NCAA tournament and kind of hangs their hat on being defensive players.
I know we can at least ask you some questions now, because when you were on NBC5 on Sports Sunday, you weren't able to answer. But trading up the day before the draft from 8 to 7, there was a huge amount of people who wondered if that was to get Angel Reese. So now that it happened, what was the thought process? Were you ultimately drafted Angel Reese and you got the spot you wanted?
Yeah, I think our thought process was we wanted to be sure that we were in that top 7. And there's a lot of good players there, but we got the target we were hoping for. I think we know how fortunate we are that we had 3 players up on that board. And making that move to 7, having 3, 7, and 13, and landing everybody that we had hoped for, that we were beyond thrilled and still are.
What was it about Camilla that convinced you that she should be your first pick?
I think to go along with the 6-7, the athleticism and the speed, and the fact that she's been very successful against pros already, you know, playing overseas and a lot of the Brazilian stuff. She's a winner. She comes from a winning program, you know, looking at, you know, her characteristics as a basketball player, you know, she has great hands. She finishes a lot. She's a great defensive anchor, but just the fact that she can outrun players at her position, you know, you can work with that very easily. And she has an amazing story. You know, we're looking for people with real toughness here in Chicago and, you know, coming over to this country at, you know, 14, 15 years old without her family and getting to where she is today that's our type of person.
Dan, Layla, and I have been talking about this as it pertains to Camilla, that one of the things that she does well as a big is she doesn't make herself small. When you see her in games in South Carolina, when she gets the ball in the post, the ball is held high. And I don't know, I mean, with your experience in basketball for all these years, if that's something that is innate to great bigs, or is that something that can be taught? Because it's such an advantage, especially when you're 6'7".
Yeah, she doesn't play small, and I think that'll be one less thing for Coach Spoon to yell at her about. She doesn't bring the ball down. You know, she turns with intention, and that's why I think she's such a great passer. I mean, and I think that's going to help us out a ton, too, having a big at that size as a traditional 5 that can turn and find shooters. So her vision is good along with everything else.
I know this is probably more of a question for ownership or upper management, but considering the position that you're in and the fact that you happen to be the person we're interviewing, How can the Sky ensure that they are doing the same pro basketball business as the example setters right now in the WNBA when it comes to the quality of practice facilities, when it comes to travel, when it comes to accommodations and all the extra things? How important is it to you that whether it's to free agents or anyone else, that you are selling a top of the line, first class WNBA experience?
Yeah, it's super important to me, and it's super important to them. They went and got a Hall of Fame player as a coach. We built an incredible staff, got everybody that we wanted. We were in daily conversations about practice facilities. Since I've taken the job, I can tell you there's nothing that I've asked for that I haven't gotten for these players. So, you know, nothing from me on that end, but positivity.
You're known for being an established trainer of professional athletes, namely basketball players. Is there something that you believe in on that side of it that you've seen really pay off? Maybe something that you really believe in, whether it's doing more cardio or preventing injuries. Is there something that you think that stands out to you as something that has really helped players that you've seen or is successful?
Yeah, my background is in player development. And as a staff, even with our head coach, you know, that is a majority of our backgrounds. And, you know, coach and I spent a lot of time with NBA players. So the details and the player development and the intentionality that how we're going to grow their games and develop them and the speed that we think we can do that versus maybe some other places is why we think we have a real weapon here in Chicago now.
What made you say, I want to partner with Spoon?
Well, I think we are fully aligned, you know, on a lot of things. And, you know, we are very attuned to the importance of relationships, culture, toughness. I think we both put behavior and people in front of the basketball. And after our first conversation, when we met 6 months ago, I realized this is exactly who I wanted to work with because we saw people the same way. We saw basketball the same way. And it's all about toughness and culture out here first. And she's driving that one.
I heard her say it yesterday. And I heard her say that when asked about X's and O's and are they going to incorporate some plays that are sets for the two bigs, whether it's high-low stuff or side-to-side stuff, she said there will be time for that. The relationships are more important to her right now. And I'm still thinking X's and O's. And I'm wondering to the extent that through a development lens, do you mm-hmm. similarly look at the game as becoming positionless and the way the game is being spaced right now, the understanding of how three is more than two and coming to grips with it? Maybe you don't need a traditional point guard. You don't have the 1 through 5 positions as we currently know. Is that also an important part of envisioning where the women's game is going if it's not there already?
Yeah, I think we're looking for basketball players here. So, you know, depending on the situation, we want you to use your instincts and your common sense. You get a rebound and you could beat somebody, make a play for somebody else. We want you to do that. You want to be as positionless as possible because at any time, depending on where the clock is, you know, you want to be able to make a play. So, you know, we're going to give our players a ton of confidence and Spoon's the one for the job, for sure.
How do you go about developing? Like, I saw Angel Reese taking NBA three-pointers, and her and Camilla combined for, what, 5 in college. How do you take what she already is a great player, a creator, and someone who can bang down low versus extending her out and finding out if she's going to be able to develop a three-point game?
Yeah, I won't be surprised if they both become good shooters over time. When you're at programs like they both came from, you know, you're sacrificing every single day to win championships and to make it to Final Fours. And I think that's what we saw from them. They were playing their roles. And as a professional, that's what you come and do. You know, you come in and you play your role. And now we want them to evolve in those roles. And we want them, the better shooters they become, you know, the better team will be. We want them to become good shooters. So those are things that we're going to hit immediately, you know, when they get into Chicago.
I saw your quote about Brenna Maxwell, who you guys picked at 13th overall out of Gonzaga, that you believe she's the best shooter in the nation. Why do you believe that? And what more can you tell us about why you wanted her on the Sky?
Yeah, I'm sticking to that one. We've been watching her for a long time. There's not a lot of players that can shoot the ball as quickly as she can shoot it, under as much stress as she shot it. Long closeouts, and one threes on the move. She has a lot of creativity as a shooter. She's not just a catch and shoot. And she hunts shots. You know, she wants to take big ones. She helped her team go very far in the NCAA tournament. And, you know, look, shooting will always be at a premium, especially, you know, where we're at right now with basketball. So, you know, drafting, you know, two front court players, you know, the need became making sure we had a specialist. And I feel very strongly that we got somebody very, very special there.
Jeff, as much as you're willing to share, how hard has the road been back for Diamond DeShields?
I think Diamond has been through a ton, even before, right, these last couple seasons with some injuries. Obviously, she went through a lot, you know, during her tenure with the Sky initially here. I saw her an hour ago. She was moving great. She's always in good spirits. She's kind of reborn now. And, you know, after the draft, you know, we went downstairs to meet with the fans. And when they saw her, I mean, you couldn't hear a thing because of the applause, you know. Yeah, I was trying to get some words out, but they were screaming and clapping for Diamond. So, you know, it's just an unbelievable, inspirational story. And she's somebody we want here, you know, to make sure she can keep mentoring a lot of the new ones coming in about, look, the game could be taken away from you and you could still fight back and be great again.
Well, one of the things about her that was so special is obviously coming from a great athletic family. But she was one of those players that you go, she's got crazy athleticism. Is she close to being back to that, or does she have to change the player that she is now because of everything she's gone through?
That's a great question. You'll see probably even a better athletic version of Diamond DeShields. She's stronger. She's faster now. You know, her body is healthy and we're moving her along very slowly. You know, she is in a great place right now, but you know, we're in no rush because we want her to be very, very comfortable, you know, when the games start.
What was that conversation like trying to recruit Diamond back and the discussion about her finding a place that she's familiar with and you have that role idea for her?
Well, you know, I started here in my role. They hired me to train Diamond. And, you know, now that I came back and, you know, accepted the role as general manager, that was one of the first players I went to go get, you know, when I knew she was a free agent. You know, she's a big part of my story. And I just know how inspirational she is to this city. And she kind of fits the culture, you know, of what we're trying to do here. Super tough and just relentless fight.
Lastly, for me, when you talk from a developmental perspective, and I know this is now a player on another team, and I'm not asking for a specific opinion about Caitlin
Sure.
Clark, but we talk about the influence and the impact that she's going to have. That when we talk about 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds, like when at some point we are going to get the next wave of young players who want to be like what the next Steph Curry, and that idea was of being, hey, I'm going to shoot it from anywhere. Because that's what I can do. I've seen somebody do it, and I can do it. What would you advise somebody who's maybe coaching a young player at this point? Is like, I want to be like this, and I'm going to pull up from the logo, and I'm going to learn how to shoot it. Is that something you want to encourage a young player to do and say, well, if you can do it, do it? Or do you want to wait until there's certain physical development where you don't learn bad habits trying to launch some of those shots?
Yeah, I think Steph Curry started a few years ago. I don't know what to say on this one. I think you got to listen to your coach. You know, I know we're going to listen to ours. But at that young age, I mean, it's just, the Caitlin Clarks of the world are inspiring incredible, you know, amounts of young boys, young girls, you know, to go chase their dreams. And to me, you know, that's the much bigger point, is that you're going to get some people that really want to cultivate their games and try to get to where she is. You know, because the visibility has shown that, you know, you work really hard and you can be really good. You know, so to me, like, I watch as a fan, You know, I know, you know, a lot of people I know watch as fans. I mean, she's done incredible things for the game. We're moving into this moment right now in women's basketball, you know, especially in the WNBA. And it's driven by people like Angel, by people like Caitlin Clark. And I think it's just going to keep opening doors for kids to want to be great basketball players.
Well, speaking of open doors and whatnot, it seems like the game on June 23rd is already sold out. I know some people were petitioning you guys to move it to the United Center, but logistics matter. There might be concerts or whatever at the UC.
Right.
Is something like that even possible for you guys to do?
I'm not sure if it's possible this year, but yes, I've gotten a few of those emails as well. You know, I think it's going to be quite a year, you know, for the Sky, for the whole WNBA. We can't wait.
All right.
That's outstanding.
Jeff, thanks for your time, man. We appreciate it.
Guys, the best. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Jeff Pagliocca, general manager of the Chicago Sky.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of concerts at the United Center when the winter tenants are gone.
I think there is one that day.
I wouldn't be surprised. They do a lot of country music stuff over there. Like, you never know when, you know, whoever's going to be in town. But
I'm looking it up to see.
What it tells you is that there is a demand for this. And it's like, how do you leave that money on the table? And Wintrust isn't a small venue. It holds 10,000.
I thought it's that's about perfect for generally what you need.
100%.
It's just right.
Yeah. And it doesn't.
What does the pavilion hold? Eight?
Yeah.
Eight and a half?
I think maybe seven.
Because they redid it. I don't know if they lost seats.
And like the college venues in town, they're way too small.
That weekend, it's Justin Timberlake on Friday and Saturday, and then Russ on the 23rd.
Yeah, so.
So that's kind of a hopping weekend there at the old UC.
Yeah, so you can't move the game
Janet
there.
Janet Jackson is Wednesday, June 19th.
I mean, you could get creative. They're probably not using Soldier Field on June 23rd.
You can't play an outdoor.
Why can't you? Caitlin already played an outdoor game.
Yeah, you'd rather not with the wind and everything.
I understand that, but they had 60,000 show for Iowa DePaul earlier this year.
And Usher is three nights at the UC, October 28th, Usher, 29th,
Usher,
and 31st.
Usher.
That's all.
So I think we actually have a regular-ass segment next because of the baseball coming up, correct?
Yeah, I have to go, though.
Okay, well, you have a job. That's okay.
Bye.
Bye.
See you Friday.
Bernstein and Holmes, your midday destination for Chicago sports talk on Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
You want some Cubs tickets? You can have them. If you're caller 6 to the contest line, 312-540-0670, right now you'll win a pair of tickets to see the Cubs take on the Marlins at Wrigley Field this Sunday, April 21st, 1:20, first pitch. And join the Score in Budweiser Thursday, May 2nd at Harry Carey's Tavern, Navy Pier for the 26th annual Worldwide Toast to Harry Carey. Parkins and Spiegel will be there broadcasting live from 4 to 7 p.m. with actor and comedian Jason Alexander leading the toast at 5:30. The Worldwide Toast to Harry Carey is brought to you by Budweiser. This Bud's for you.
I'm not trying to be hyperbolic about this, but shouldn't the Jontay Porter story be kind of leading every national sports thing?
Well, what Aaron Rodgers would say, it's a conspiracy because every national sports thing knows who's paying them most of their money right now, and maybe the leagues and the gambling houses and everybody else don't want to know that a guy has just been banned from the NBA
for life
with no chance of reinstatement.
The NWO.
NWO, sorry, not NWA.
For life. Like, this is the thing that everyone in sports at the highest level had always feared, that you start thinking about some of the point shaving scandals that we've seen, that you worry if they can crush a sport. Now, it's not going to crush the NBA. The NBA is going to still continue to print money. But if enough of this stuff happens, and I think that's why this serves as a, I think that Adam Silver is looking at this as like, this is how serious it is. Like, this isn't like the guys in Detroit in the NFL where I was placing a bet on college football, but I happened to be on campus therefore I have to be suspended 6 games. This is a guy actively shaving, actively trying to make his team lose and betting that his team would lose.
You have to go to famous collegiate scandals. This goes all the way back to CCNY.
This is what I was thinking about.
This goes back to CCNY in the 50s. And off the top of my head, there were two involving Northwestern sports. There was the fumbling on purpose by Dennis Lundy and others, and there was also the Northwestern basketball point-shaving scandal. I want to say, of coincidentally, Tulane had one in the 1980s when they were getting good with Hot Rod. John Hot Rod Williams was there, and I believe that there was found to be at least enough suspicion of point-shaving. This is well beyond the whole Tim Donaghy concern about having a dirty referee. The NBA just banned a guy for life.
Yes.
Can I read you let's take Adam Silver at his own words here.
Yeah. The release that was sent out by the NBA. So, like, just so you know, like, I wasn't saying that anyone's trying to hide it, and the NBA clearly wasn't. They put a full-throated statement out earlier this morning once the decision had been rendered.
A league investigation found that Porter violated league rules by disclosing confidential information to sports bettors, limiting his own participation in one or more games for betting purposes, and betting on NBA games. The league's investigation found that prior to the Raptors' March 20th game, Porter disclosed confidential information about his own health to an individual he knew to be an NBA bettor. Another individual with whom Porter associated and knew to be an NBA bettor subsequently placed an $80,000 parlay proposition bet with an online sportsbook to win $1.1 million, wagering that Porter would underperform in that game. The league's investigation also found that Porter limited his own game participation to influence the outcome of one or more bets on his performance in at least one Raptors game. In the March 20th game, Porter played only 3 minutes, claiming that he felt ill. Due to the unusual betting activity and actions of the player, the $80,000 proposition bet was frozen and was not paid out. In addition, from January through March 2024, when traveling with the Raptors or Raptors 905, the Raptors NBA G League affiliate, Porter placed at least 13 bets on NBA games using an associate's online betting account. The bets ranged in size from $15 to $22,000 for a total of $54,094. The total payout was $76,059, resulting in net winnings of $21,965. None of the bets involved any game in which Porter played. Three of the bets were multi-game parlay bets that included one Raptors game in which Porter bet that the Raptors would lose. All three bets lost. Wow, the suspicious bets were brought to the NBA's attention by licensed sports betting operators and an organization that monitors legal betting markets.
Okay, so that's good that there are some guardrails up that went into place. Like, wait, what's going on? How much is being dropped on this guy, this fringe NBA player? Why is there so much money on his props?
And these are the ones they're worried about, the incentivization for someone who doesn't make a lot of money and doesn't play very much. That's where that dangerous cohort might be. Here's the quote from Adam Silver. There's nothing more important than protecting the integrity of NBA competition for our fans, our teams, and everyone associated with our sport, which is why Jonte Porter's blatant violations of our gaming rules are being met with the most severe punishment. While legal sports betting creates transparency that helps identify suspicious or abnormal activity, this matter also raises important issues about the sufficiency of the regulatory framework currently in place, including the types of bets offered on our games and players. Working closely with all relevant stakeholders across the industry, we will continue to work diligently to safeguard our league and game.
This is part of the reason why there's been a movement to get rid of props in college basketball. That, why don't you take some of the temptation out of it? But this feels like it should be a big thing. Like, this is a, like, I wonder in pregame tonight, is Billy Donovan asked about this? Like, that sort of thing.
And other leagues too. That's why we asked Florio, and why Florio was smart enough to write about what the NFL ramifications are. All these commissioners should be on a conference call right now, because the other sports are saying, glad it was the NBA, wasn't us. As far as you know,
Shohei. Right. Like, think the two biggest stories that we've had over the last couple of weeks have been what's gone on with Shohei and this. That's terrifying. In one case, you have either a player being involved in sports betting and racking up a giant debt, or what it seems to look like is a player being taken advantage of because of sports betting. And in the case of Jontay Porter, you've got a guy whose brother is rich as hell.
I was just looking up Michael Porter Jr. while you were talking.
Michael Porter Jr. has made over like $120 million, right, in his career? And you have a guy that makes it to the league, and he feels it necessary to do this. I don't know what they do just because, and we're involved. We do FanDuel. We work with betting operations as well. If you're the NBA and that money is coming in to your league and it's been good for your league, how do you separate that from the players? I don't know. But this, I hope that if there are other people around the league that are even messing around with this, that maybe it'll... I hope that they're not thinking it won't be me, because it could definitely be you, especially if you're not doing it in a well-crafted way. And clearly, Jontay Porter was not.
Well, what I would like to see, too, is some sort of standardization, either with FIBA as a part of it or other basketball entities, where Jontay Porter's like, fine, I can't play in the NBA. I'll go play in Greece or I'll go play in China. And there's bets taken on those games as well.
100%.
Thanks to a great slate of guests today. Dawn Staley, Mike Florio, Nick Friedel, and Jeff Pagliacca. Thanks to Layla for her availability on Wednesdays. As always, Ray Diaz, Adam Studzinski, Brandon Fryer, Kevin Lapka, Connor O'Donnell for all of their help. Cubs baseball is next.